What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off. Ken Wynn is the founder and CEO of Republic. This conversation covered a lot, including him working at AngelList, the variations of securities law, building a startup in a highly regulated market, and why tokenization could eradicate global poverty, according to Ken. This conversation was a lot of fun, and I hope you enjoy it nearly as much as I did. This podcast is presented by Blockworks Group, the only blockchain event and media production company I trust. If you're an investor, lawyer, accountant, or entrepreneur, and want to attend exclusive events and dinners, visit them at blockworksgroup.io. I promise you won't be disappointed.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, I'm super excited. I've got Ken here. We've got a lot to get through, but our goal today is we want to create the single source of truth for all things tokenization. So whenever somebody asks you, what is tokenization? Why is it important? You can send them this one podcast episode. So tall task, no pressure, Ken.
Thank you so much, Anthony, for having me.
Absolutely. All right. So real quick, just so people have perspective, how did you get into crypto? What's your background? Let's go through all that and then we can jump into the tokenization stuff.
Definitely started out as a securities lawyer. Worked in finance, went back to academia, and then joined AngelList as their general counsel back in 2014. And then so I spun out an affiliated entity called Republic to allow retail investors to invest in stock, common stock, preferred stock, early stage companies. And then from then on, in 2017, AngelList set up CoinList. And in the course of that, seeing very well that these tokens, a lot of them are going to be deemed to be securities, meaning you got to find a compliant way for everyday people to participate and own tokens. And that's why we launched Republic Crypto.
Got it. And so let's talk about the securities law stuff first, right? Mm. So what were you doing there? Kind of what was the things that interested you on the security side kind of pre-crypto, right? Because now a lot of that stuff's super applicable. Yep. But what were you doing?
The way that I view fintech, it's basically half legal and half business. And then if you deal with Silicon Valley, then a component of engineering. When you deal with investment, there's an 80 years, of securities law to deal with. Crypto navigates at the forefront, at the very edges of financial technology, which means the legal component is probably going to be 70% or so. And so it's about navigating the murky landscape, going far enough to be ahead of the game, but not overstepping so that you end up in federal prison. Right? It's a delicate dance. So I think law is always going to be a key part of fintech, but in crypto, it's going to be, it has already been a major component.
Absolutely. That makes complete sense. And so you go from securities law into the finance side, right? So maybe talk a little bit about kind of what type of financial organizations there.
You mean before?
You. Yep. Yeah.
So when I left Goodwin Procter, I joined a massive asset management firm, straight up fund of funds. Our counterparties was like Lehman's and Bear Stearns and whatnot. And it was just structuring fund product,
RIP to those guys.
Exactly. LP, GP, dish out, checks into billions into, traditional assets. Mm-hmm. It got boring very quick, right? It wasn't a whole lot of creativity. So I went back into academia and then AngelList itself is a fund manager, the syndication model. And so we applied the same thing. We nudged the boundary a little bit there on broker-dealer investment advisory law.
Yep.
And then we left when the law changed to allow retail investors to invest in early stage companies.
Very cool. And so when you go to spin out Republic, we'll get to that in a second, right? But let's talk about AngelList kind of pre you spinning Republic out, right? Because I think a lot of people don't really know what AngelList is, what the benefits are, but it's changed the way that people look at financing private companies, right? So maybe talk about kind of what AngelList does and why it's important.
So Navo and Nivi started AngelList back in 2011, mainly to provide more information to entrepreneurs. venture financing, which is, you know, this black box. You're either lucky enough to get to someone and get rejected without knowing why. This was, I mean, very little information at the time. Mm-hmm. So it started out just as a literally a blog, a venture hack. And then over time, I think they saw an opportunity that once you build an ecosystem of entrepreneurs and investor, then you can facilitate investment. Mm-hmm. The moment that you do that, the moment that you monetize on investment activities, then regulations kick in. And so they hired me as their first general counsel when they first launched the syndicate product, matching investors to underlying startups.
Absolutely. And so what's been the impact of AngelList, right? Because it really did open up information, access, et cetera. But how do you look at that impact in non-crypto or non-tokenized world, but in still private startups?
I would say before AngelList, you gotta be very lucky to know one of three dozen extremely well-connected individuals in Silicon Valley in order to get financing. So even if you're a very high net worth person here in Wall Street or in Alaska, you didn't have access to deals and you didn't really care or know how to vet early stage startups. Mm-hmm. So by establishing a platform that a lot more high net worth individuals now can finance projects, it increased the pool of capital and it necessarily led to a much wider field of entrepreneurs who got funded since, you know, 2013-14.
Absolutely. All right. So you end up seeing the change in the law that allows retail investors to participate in this and really unaccredited investors, right, is what we're talking about. And you go to Spin Republic out. Let's start with just what is tokenization, right? So in your mind, that term gets thrown around all over the place. What does it mean to you?
Yep. For me, it's basically employing this new technology, blockchain technology, that would bring a level of fractionalization unprecedented because it's so cheap. The simplicity of fractionalizing something and the automated impact of basically remove the administrative cost out of it. So I would say liquidity and fractionalization are two elements that you add on to traditional financing. And those two key elements alone, in my opinion, would generate, I don't even know how many hundreds of billions, if not trillions, of value once you disintermediate the middlemen that are permeating throughout the banking system.
Absolutely. And so as you're doing this, what type of regulatory environment is there, right? So the technology is one piece, and we can talk about that in a second, but the regulations make this possible, right? And so let's go through kind of each one of the regulations that exist and then the exemptions themselves, right? So if you don't use an exemption, what are your options as an entrepreneur to fundraise?
You know, and if you allow me, Anthony, to just backtrack one little bit, because the reason why Congress passed this law to allow everyone to invest, doesn't matter if you're a millionaire or not, they didn't consider crypto, of course, at the time. Mm-hmm. But the purpose behind that was actually realized by the wave of ICO unbeknownst to Congress. So the reason why they opened up, they changed the law to allow everyone to invest, was that the number or the type of entrepreneurs that got funded by venture capitalists fit a very particular mold. Mm-hmm. They got to be massive, or companies with massive potential, mostly people, young males from Stanford, Harvard, and the like.
And traditional venture capital mold that we think of.
Correct. So basically, it's a very narrow lens. And the other side of the coin was that pretty much everyone else, 99.9% of the population, didn't get to participate in what has been the biggest wealth generation event until crypto. So we lobbied Congress, and then they changed the law to allow for minimal, small participation so that even a teacher in Alaska can invest $50 in the next Uber. And that $50, if Uber does really well, can be more than $1 million worth in value.
And this regulation was called what?
The Jobs Act,
the
Title
Jobs
3,
Act.
Yep, or regulation crowdfunding. So ICO, of course, at the time, and there were already ICOs being done in 2015-16 in Asia, you have people anywhere, everywhere, funding, financing businesses, projects, in a way that was much further than what the law even contemplated or hoped it could be. So now it's just basically in the US, it's using an existing legal framework to try to make what has already been an industry practice more compliant and possible.
Mm-hmm. So really what people are doing is they're taking a law that exists on the books and they're interpreting it in a new way based on technology that was not available when the law actually passed.
Or another way to look at it is that now there's a framework, there's a legal framework that does allow for everyone to participate, does allow for open participation, but you have to operate within this legal framework because otherwise the legal risk, not just from the SEC, you know, cramming down, is from potential investor lawsuits. It's just too high. Mm-hmm. So the current legal framework does actually work. It does come with a cost, but it does work.
Mm-hmm. No, it makes sense. Let's start a business, a hypothetical business right now, right? So you and I want to start a construction company, kind of just a traditional mainstream company that does not have the multi-billion dollar potential, right? So we're talking about a traditional business. And to get started, we need to go buy some equipment, right? We need to hire some people, kind of get operations off the ground. And so we need to raise some capital.
Yep.
What are our options today?
So first, you got to form a company,
Okay. Either
a limited liability company or a true corporation. It's essentially just a legal entity.
Mm-hmm. And pretty cheap, pretty fast to do this.
Pretty cheap, pretty fast. An LLC can be formed in like less than 48 hours, a couple hundred bucks. Mm-hmm. Same thing for a corporation. What you do with that entity, how you're going to fundraise, how you're going to capitalize it. Now, that's a range of options.
Okay.
You can go to a bank and say, I have great credit, you know, score. Please lend me $1 million. Mm-hmm. That's probably going to be a hard sell unless you already have a lot of assets.
And it's a hard sell because they don't have a lot of collateral at the business. It's new.
Correct.
There's no history.
Then they would have to reach back to your personal asset to do it. So for, you know, someone who's under 30, for most people, that's not a reality.
Yep.
The second one is to convince friends, family that, hey, I'm building this business. It's going to be really profitable. Why don't you lend me some money and I'll pay you back? Mm-hmm. Another way, lending money and paying you back, it's just fixed income, right? So over a period of time, you get back 10%, 12% interest every single year. Not super interesting. Or you can tell...
And it's hard to do because most friends and family aren't used to lending to businesses.
Correct. And they may not have the capital to lend. For example, if you lend someone $10,000, that means 10% out of that every single year, you're going to get $1,000 back. Convincing people to lend you $10,000 so that every single year they get a bit of return, that's a hard sell.
Absolutely.
Or you can go to 20 friends and say, hey guys, this is going to be a big business and I'm going to sell it one day for a lot of money. Why don't you each buy in $500? So all together I get $10,000. I'm not going to pay you back anything until the company makes it big. And then your $500 is now going to be $50,000. That's the equity sales for people to participate.
Got it.
VC essentially fits into the latter, you know, the latter framework.
And so if I don't get a bank or my friends to lend me capital, right, non-dilutive capital, then I've got to go and raise equity capital, right, to fund the company. The options there would be I can go to professional investors, right? Venture capital funds, et cetera. I can go to friends and family. They can buy some of that, like you described. But then there is this new regulation, right, that has come out where these exemptions under the Jobs Act allow me to raise equity capital. So I sell a piece of my business to people I might not know, right? So not friends and family, and they're not professional investors. What's my range of options there on the regulation side?
Since the Great Depression until about 2.5 years ago, if you are raising from people who you don't know and don't know well, you can only raise from so-called accredited investors. That means institutions. That means loosely defined people who are millionaires.
Okay. So pre-Jobs Act, you can only raise money from accredited investors. And this is something that's available. This is something that is across the United States. Across the world, does everyone use this accreditation? Talk me through kind of how this applies on a global scale.
In much of the developed world, there's a limit or there's a minimum requirement on anyone seeking to invest in an early stage company. These legal frameworks really to protect investors. You don't want, you know, grandmas and teachers quote unquote, loosely defined by the law, unsophisticated, financially unsophisticated, to get duped into investment opportunities. The law assumed that if you're rich enough, that you know enough in order to protect yourself.
So wealth is used as a proxy for sophistication or intelligence.
Unfortunately, in the US, that's the case.
Okay.
And obviously in practice, that's not the case.
Of course, I've said it before. There's a lot of dumb rich people, right?
In fact, the United States is the only country among the developed world that doesn't have a sophistication standard based on how much you know rather than how much your net worth is.
Oh, so interesting. So other countries have both a wealth criteria and a sophistication criteria.
Correct. So in the UK or Canada, if you have spent a year working for a financial institution in an investment capacity, then you deem to be an accredited investor. Their definition of accredited
investor.
Got it. Investor.
And so really it's an either or, right? You can have $1 million or meet some wealth criteria, or you could have worked for a year at a Goldman Sachs, wherever.
Correct. And this, the standard in the US is that you got to make at least $200,000 in salary the past 2 years or have a net worth of $1 million or more.
Got it. Okay. And so today, if you and I have that construction company, we want to go raise capital. We've got Reg D, right? Regulation D, which is an exemption under the Jobs Act.
Correct.
Reg S, Reg A plus and Reg CF. So those are the four?
Reg A plus and Reg CF are new legal frameworks since 2016, of course.
Okay.
Yes, but those are the four main ones.
And so what a lot of people don't understand is when we talk about these regulations, these are exemptions to securities law. So this was part of a deregulation of the industry, right? To make it easier for people to raise capital without going through the steps required by legacy securities law. Real quick, just touch on what were those steps? Why was it so hard to leverage securities law to raise capital before the regulation exemptions came in?
So after the Great Depression, securities law in the US basically draw a red line. In order for a company to raise money from retail public, non-accredited investor, or to raise money at all, you got to be a registered company, meaning a public company, meaning going IPO.
Okay.
The cost of being a public company just to file the form is a couple $1 million at least, and a few more $1 million per year just to maintain it.
And where does that money go, right? So everyone hears that registering or becoming public company is very expensive.
Yep.
But what are you paying money for?
Legal fees, of course. The GAAP accounting that is required by law, and just the fleet of accountants and lawyers to comply with all of that is extremely expensive. Internally, you have to have a record-keeping system. Just the operational framework to be a public company is excessively high.
Okay.
So either you have to be a public company or you're exempted by the law from the registration requirement.
So you can raise money from a non-accredited investor if you're one public company that is expensive and requires a lot of kind of a higher degree difficulty, things to remain public and compliant, et cetera. Or you can leverage an exemption from being public to raise capital. And that's what we're talking about with Reg D, Reg S, A plus, CF.
Correct. So it's not just retail non-accredited. If you want to raise money from the public, either you have to be fully registered or you have to fit one of the exemptions.
Okay.
Reg D, the first exemption, says that if you're just raising from accredited investors only, again, millionaires, then that's one exemption. But if you take in a single non-accredited investor, you lose the exemption.
Okay, so let's go deep on Reg D for a second. If I and you have the construction company and we want to raise money through Reg D, we can only take accredited investors' money.
Correct.
Can we raise as much as we want?
You can raise an unlimited amount.
Okay. And how can we market to those individuals? So we have to know they're accredited, but can I just go on television and say, hey, I'm raising money. Do you, you know, call my cell phone if you want to put money in, or how do I actually market to them?
No, we're getting to a deeper level of legal nuances.
That's why you're here.
If you go on TV, yes, you can put on a billboard in the subway, you know, Wall Street Journal, go on TV and publicly announce to the world that you're fundraising, but you have to verify that everyone you are taking in to the round, taking money, is truly accredited.
Okay.
So you have to look at their tax return, or you have to get an attorney to verify it. You know, the verification of accreditation is a
It's pretty high.
Complicated threshold. If you don't publicly announce it and you just go to people that you know and their friends, then you can reasonably rely on people's accreditation representation without having to verify.
So this is an important nuance. If I want to do billboards, television commercials, go on the news, kind of publicly solicit funds from people I don't know,
yep,
I have to verify that they're accredited.
Yes.
But if I actually rely on personal relationships and it's from people that I know, I can simply ask in a kind of predetermined way, are you accredited? And if they tell me yes, that meets the barrier or that meets the criteria that I can rely on their self-accreditation.
Yes. So, and the threshold is pretty easy. And this is a loose threshold, not a legal threshold. If you go on live, you Google someone's fundraising round and it doesn't come up, you know, the person is technically not publicly fundraising, right? You can still do a billboard ad and somehow doesn't make it on the internet, but nowadays that's unlikely.
Got it. Okay. So that's Reg D. Reg S is what?
So Reg S is if you fundraise from non-US investors outside of the US, then the SEC, Securities Exchange Commission, takes the view that it's not our business. But you have to take a few steps to make sure that your offering is not accessible by US investors and that you don't, in fact, have a US resident somehow investing in the round.
So our construction company, we say, actually, we don't want US investors. We want to raise money from international investors. We're allowed to go do that without having to comply with U.S. accreditation law.
Correct.
If we ensure that U.S. investors won't invest in the offering.
But you do have to comply with the local laws that may apply to the round, right?
Okay. See how I asked that question that way? So if we want to raise capital internationally, and let's say that we have interest in, I don't know, Singapore, India, and the U.K., right? We don't have to worry about the U.S. accreditation criteria as long as we're ensuring no U.S. investors are participating. But we do have to make sure that we're compliant in the U.K., or I say India and Singapore, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And you have to take that into account.
Okay. Because you won't be in violation of U.S. securities law, but you would be in violation of U.K., India, Singapore's securities
Absolutely.
Law.
Absolutely. If you're out in Singapore pitching your offering to Singaporean residents, Singapore laws would apply.
Okay. So in recap, Reg D, accredited investors in the U.S., pretty cut and dry, well understood.
Cheap to do.
Yeah, cheap to do. And this is a little bit of the rich get richer because you can only raise money from rich people.
Correct.
Right? Reg S says a lot of the same stuff, but you just won't take money from U.S. investors. You'll take money from international investors and you'll go through the steps to make sure U.S. investors don't participate. All right. So that's all, you know, fairly well understood. Let's get into the fun stuff now. So we've got Reg A Plus and we've got Reg CF. Let's start with Reg A Plus because I think more people understand that. What exactly is Reg A Plus and what are the things that I can do with that maybe I can't do with the other exemptions?
So Reg CF, Reg A Plus going IPO are three ways that you can accept non-accredited money in the US.
Okay, so IPO, Reg A Plus, and Reg CF.
Correct.
Okay.
And the way that you should look at it is in terms of complexity and cost.
Okay.
So IPO probably a year or more to prepare for it. And the cost is a couple million dollars all the way to like $15, $20 million to do an IPO and then maintenance cost.
So an IPO really is time consuming and expensive and likely only done by large companies that are well capitalized, et cetera.
Correct.
Okay.
And then everyone anywhere can just openly buy. I mean,
yep,
the Google, Apple, Facebook of the world.
Got it.
Reg A Plus is a couple notches below that in terms of cost and timing as well.
Okay.
So law firms now quote about $1 million or so to $2 million to do the cost of a Reg A filing. That's just the legal fee. In crypto space, the time that it would take for the SEC to approve a Reg A Plus application can be 6 months or 8 months or more. In fact, to date, there hasn't been a single approval by the SEC for a Reg A Plus campaign.
So a Reg A Plus is a little bit less expensive, a little bit shorter time frame, but it's still not this, you know, the creation of an LLC, which is a couple hundred bucks in 48 hours. We're talking 6+ months and still, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not $1 million+.
Correct. And there's a limit on how much you can raise.
Okay, so let's talk about that.
And that limit is currently at $50 million and soon will be $75 million. If you do an IPO, you can raise whatever money that people are willing to invest in the billions.
So an IPO, I can raise as much money as I want from unaccredited investors. With A+, I can only raise up to 50.
Correct.
But they can be unaccredited.
Yep. Accredited or unaccredited or accredited.
Okay, so it can be either. Is there a limit on the number or on the check size they write?
Yeah. So generally, no. That is the now. In reality, the people, the type of people would invest, you know, millions are generally all accredited.
Yep. So you can go raise. I could raise up to $50 million from unaccredited investors using Reg A Plus, and everyone could put in $10.
Correct.
Got it. How can I find these people? Can I go on television and you know, promote it and billboards and put it all over the internet?
Or do absolutely. I have to, okay. Absolutely. You can launch, you know, your own website. You can then, you know, do Facebook ads to the extent that they accept you. Anything, public promotion, advertisement, as long as you disclose it.
Got it. So that's Reg A+. CF, almost nobody knows about. It's the most misunderstood or unknown regulation exemption, and it's what you guys are focused on.
Correct. And full disclosure, that's what Republic's been doing since summer of 2016. And it's a big drop off in terms of everything. It takes about 2 weeks to launch a campaign. It can be as cheap as $3,000-$4,000, but there's a limit. It's a pretty low limit. No company can raise more than $1 million, 1.07 to be precise, per year.
Okay. So if we got our construction company and we need couple hundred thousand dollars or $1 million to get started.
Yep.
We can go. It takes us a couple of weeks. I'll say, you know, a month or less. We can spend less than $5,000.
Yep.
We can raise money from accredited or unaccredited investors. They can write as little as $10 up to whatever size check they want, but we can't raise more than $1.07 million in a 12-month period.
Correct. They actually, each investor, there's a cap. No one can put in more than $100,000 in a Reg CF campaign.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And that's the maximum. Anyone, even a student, even if you're greatly in debt, the law deems that anyone can invest at least $2,200, no question asked.
Okay.
Above $2,200 is a fraction of your income or net worth. So if you are a teacher making $100,000 a year at a private school, you cannot invest more than $10,000 in a Reg CF campaign.
So you can only do up to 10% of your income into a single investment.
Correct. And even you or Tim Draper cannot invest more than $100,000 per year in Reg CF opportunities.
Oh, so me as an investor, total, even if I like 15 different Reg CFs, I can only put $100,000 into Reg CF offerings.
Correct.
In totality for the year.
Exactly. And the SEC in their infinite wisdom saying that, hey, if Anthony wants to invest more money in startups, he should go to Reg D or Reg A. But Reg CF is about a small amount of money, lots of people. We want to keep it that way.
Got it. That's super interesting.
I'm not sure, but...
okay. And so... why are you guys using Reg CF? Is it because it's more of a democratic way? You get more people and smaller check sizes and you think that there's advantages there? Or explain to me, why are you so focused on that specific exemption?
You know, whether it's traditional finance or crypto, it's about access. For crypto, it's even that much more important because you really do need to get these tokens into the hand of, you know, developers in college to start working and building. So... if it's going to cost a project or a company $1 million just to do the legal filing, that's not providing access. That's why it hasn't been practical at all. Yep. And IPOs, that's something only for like the biggest, the most mature type of companies. So there's nothing else in between. It's just either Reg CF or accredited only or outside of the US. So we think that it's a key component to bringing open access to capital and to blockchain in general.
Got it. And so let's walk through what you guys have built today. How big is the company? And then we can talk through, you know, how somebody works with you.
Right now we have two offices, the headquarters in New York with a side office in San Francisco, approximately.
Not very many people come here and say side office in San Francisco.
Approximately 40 of us. And we have a pretty balanced team. You know, a lot of people from our team came from AngelList. In fact, we deem AngelList to be an institutional co-founder. We're strong on technical and business, but one unique differentiator is that there are, I think, seven former attorneys turn crypto enthusiasts working in-house at Republic to navigate, you know, that murky area at the forefront of fintech and securities law.
Got it. And so when somebody comes to work with you, can they sell just regular private illiquid equity, or do they have to sell tokens?
We launched in 2016 to deal with just equity. That is, the first 50 companies we launched, which is traditional startups, selling convertible notes, selling preferred shares. Now, since 2017 until now, given that most new tokens are deemed by the SEC to be securities, we open up the framework to allow people to either do a SAF, pre-sale, actual token distribution, even airdrops and bounty programs as securities offerings that have to meet one of these exemptions. And so the CF framework at Republic really accommodates all types of securities.
Got it. And so if I come and I want to actually raise using a tokenized security, so it's equity in my business, right, in that construction company, but it's tokenized, can it trade on an exchange?
Absolutely. So today, there hasn't been yet an exchange in the US that has been approved to do tokenized securities trading, but I have no doubt it will come by Q1.
What does the regulation say? Is there a 12-month lockup, a 1-month lockup, 3 years? What does that lock look like till you can get to liquidity?
Let me go back to your Reg D and Reg CF distinction, and okay, let's just focus on those two being the most relevant one for projects in the US. If you issue securities, token or equity through a Reg D campaign, then for 1 year, they deem to be restricted, meaning under very limited circumstances, would you be able to trade and sell publicly?
Okay.
For Reg CF, immediately, anyone can sell a Reg CF securities to accredited investor and after 1 year to non-accredited. So there's still that lockup period for 1 year.
Got it. And let's go deeper on tokenized securities, right? Everyone's talking about this and they're saying, oh, you know, the cryptocurrencies, the Bitcoins of the world, right? There's huge potential. If it replaces, you know, the US dollar as a global reserve currency, right? We've had Murad on and just that there's huge potential there. Then there's the ICOs and utility tokens, which are kind of more access like tokens, right? So it gets you onto a network, it gets you some sort of, you know, value there. But these tokenized securities, there's hundreds of trillions of dollars of assets in the world. And so if in fact everything becomes tokenized or digitized, what does that world look like?
I would say what some deem to be somewhat controversial, but I think that a mature tokenized security world will effectively eradicate poverty around the world once and for all. And okay, there's a reason why I'm saying that. 1.4 billion people have been lifted out of extreme poverty in the past 30 years. It hasn't been due to government policy. It hasn't been due to philanthropy. It's been entrepreneurships, businesses like Uber's and Microsoft creating jobs around the world. Those companies today have been financed predominantly, exclusively by investment funds and by ultra, ultra high net worth bankers.
Professional investors.
So those professional investors for the past 30 years have picked a few that fit their liking. If you open it up for everyone, imagine energy, money is basically energy. If a mom, stay-at-home mom in China or Argentina, can invest $50 on a tokenized basis in a project in Canada or the US, if you can imagine everyone participate in early stage investing in the same way that they buy products, in the same way that they buy lottery tickets, that's that much more capital will be fueled into entrepreneurship. And the outcome of that is within a decade or two, I really think that the world will be so prosperous that we won't see extreme poverty anymore.
So highly controversial, right? What has to happen though, from where we are today, to get to what you just described?
So, and I'll use the pain points of Republic in the first 2 years before crypto as a basis as for my projection.
Okay.
So when we launched Republic in 2016, allowing everyone, quote unquote, to invest based on that same vision, But if you're sitting in China or Korea or Argentina and you want to make a $50 investment in a project on Republic before the tokenized world, well, wire fee is alone $50, $35 at the very least, possibly $50 or more. That makes it wholly unrealistic for someone to invest $50, right? After you get it, what do you do? How do you transfer, if you want to, your interest, your investment to your neighbor? You have to go through a very complex, complicated administrative process. Those two components are already being solved if the whole process of fundraising is tokenized. If you invest, you know, using ETH, the transaction fee is so low compared to traditional finance, making it possible. You can also circumvent jurisdictional cross-border limitations that exist with traditional banking system. And then, so where we are today with crypto, there's a major hurdle for adoption. The reason why you don't see more, you know, stay-at-home moms participate in crypto is that they don't understand what Blockstack means, what Filecoin means, heck, what blockchain means. Mm-hmm. But if you tokenize a traditional business, a real estate portfolio, a construction company, they get it. They don't need to know how it's done. All they need to know is that now I own a piece in this real estate portfolio and my piece is actually only $200 rather than $200,000 minimum requirement of yesteryear.
It's so funny because the everyday consumer actually can know that something will be valuable before professional investors, right? Because it solves their problem. And so they're on the ground in terms of, you know, you talk to these investors, a lot of times they're like, oh, I saw somebody was using something and therefore I became interested in it, right? Or even, you know, take Tim, for example, Tim Draper. Why did he start looking at digital assets and digital currency? Because his son asked him for money to buy right. something on a video game, right? Like, so there's, you know, that story is told so many times where the actual investor or the capital allocator is not the target market for the company. They learn about it's solving a pain point for somebody else and then decide to invest. But if we can empower the person who has the problem solved for themselves to actually be able to invest, all of a sudden you start to really change the dynamics of fundraising.
Absolutely. And it is one other element, which is professional investors are only interested in business or projects that have extreme potential return, huge market size. Then probably wouldn't be investing in a local restaurant that, you know, providing dividends and benefits in a robust company, but never yield a 10x return. On the other hand, a lot of community people would want to do that, and they may not be accredited. They want to invest $100 in that restaurant and be able to go to it and get a discount and call themselves an owner. So, by opening up, by making it easier for everyone to invest, it necessarily funds a much greater range of businesses and not just the ones that, you know, venture backable.
Got it. Let's switch around. I want to play devil's advocate with you, right? So the arguments against tokenization, right? One is that this actually isn't that important. All it is securitization. And we've seen this before. The technology is really not that interesting or that revolutionary. What do you say to that?
Coming from the fund asset management background, most people aren't aware that, well, most people are aware of credit card companies taking just a transaction fee, being that middleman and building, you know, $1 billion industry or $1 trillion industry, fund administration, the same thing, accounting, pretty much anything that requires someone to validate and be the trusted party in the middle. I think that that trusted party has permeated every single aspect of our life, and certainly in business. I can't think of more than one or two aspects of businesses that doesn't involve a middleman. If you remove that, you're gonna make it that much cheaper. And if you can help people transact at smaller dollar amounts, you're gonna increase the flow of capital. That combination, an increase pool of liquidity, along with less cost and less inefficiency, naturally will give rise to, will be such a boost to the economy and to the world in a way that no other technology, in my opinion, has been able to deliver.
Go ahead.
Take the internet as an example. What does it do? Communication, right? The ease of communication, of exchange of information. Now you're going to have that taken to the next level in terms of the ease of asset transfer and the ease of, in short, one is communication facilitation. The other one is liquidity facilitation.
For sure. So what do you say to the people who argue that tokenization doesn't actually increase liquidity, right? It doesn't change what asset it is. And so is it true that it actually changes the liquidity?
It doesn't change the money supply right off the bat. But net-net, when you make it possible for people to participate in small amount, over time, you're going to have a lot more engagement. It's kind of like voting. You can't just expect one day that you're like, hey, everyone can vote now that everyone goes to the ballot. But over the years, people now feel encouraged, feel that they have a voice. And then all of a sudden, 10 years out, and you have a highly engaged democracy. So same thing with money. If you now enable everyone to participate, both through regulations and through technology, and then by making it possible and relatable for them, you will have, you know, improve liquidity at a great scale over time.
Okay. What about people who say that none of the infrastructure exists, right? So there's no exchange right now. There's none of the things that we actually need in terms of empowering this to happen on a global scale.
We're 6 minutes into this new day. So, there are a lot of good people, but there's also a lot of money being deployed in building that foundation. As I mentioned before, today they ease in an active securities exchange in the US that can facilitate crypto. 3 more months, that may very well be different. So, hopefully an hour in rather than 6 minutes in, we can have, a lot of the tools necessary to justify my optimistic projection.
Okay. Now, this isn't a knock against it. I think it's just more of your opinion. If this happens, right, and all of these assets do become digital, right? So personally, my perspective is that 100% of assets in the world will become digital. Every currency, stock, bond, commodity, everything will become digital in terms of the way that you interact with it. If that happens, do we get away from the siloed financial world, right? So the stock exchanges today are very Western centric, if you will. Do we actually reach this like one global financial system that is more inclusive? Or do you think that it'll still be fragmented in terms of, there's a certain exchange for real estate, there's another exchange for oil and gas, and there's an exchange for just North America, and that fragmentation persists? Or do we actually get to that global financial system?
I really hope that we will get to a point where it's a global system in terms of regulations and framework. In terms of market segments, I imagine that there will always be a separate niche exchange for real estate or commodities like, tomatoes and onions and whatnot, and one for, startups, and maybe one for restaurants, one for real estate. So there will be market segmentations, but the hope of a globalized framework, I certainly would like to see that happen, within a decade.
Got it. What's your biggest fear when it comes to tokenization? What keeps you up at night?
Once a ill-informed piece of law is enacted, it's very difficult to undo it. It takes a lot of time. So I would say what keeps me up at night would be hasty decisions or actions by regulators. That may be New York regulators or the SEC or FinCEN. The BitLicense set of law is one example. But I do think with respect to the SEC, they've been very pragmatic, very thoughtful in their approach. So it's encouraging. But that concern applies in all major jurisdictions, may it be Japan, which effectively now has such a high hurdle for ICO that's not possible to do ICO in Japan because of a reaction to obviously that exchange securities concern over the summer. But I would say regulatory risk, not risk to the underlying projects, but risk of ill-informed, overly restrictive regulations.
I think that's completely fair. And I would echo your sentiment that I think U.S. regulators have done a very good job of being patient and measured and really spending the time to learn before acting, whereas maybe we haven't seen that in other jurisdictions. So I think that's completely fair.
And their view right now, which is the current legal framework, does works if you apply it to crypto. It's just that each player got to assess for themselves, are they complying? And what the ultimate legal risk would be if they don't. But yeah, I highly doubt there will be any drastic change to U.S. securities law as applied to crypto anytime soon.
I mean, look, I've said this before. We wrote up a whole thing around, I actually think the SEC or regulators in general are going to, in some form or fashion, mandate the tokenization or digitization of assets. And it's for one reason that goes unspoken of in many of these circles. Today, regulators spend a bunch of time, money, and resources to identify bad actors, to identify things that they did that actually broke the law or violated regulation. And then they have to build a case. It can usually take, you know, a year, 2 years. It's very expensive. And then they enforce, right? And they actually go after the people who did something wrong. The promise of tokenization, if it actually happens, is that you are able to KYC, AML, investor verify myself and my digital wallet, right? Also, either an issuer or another participant in the market, you can KYC, AML, investor verify. And then the actual token in which the security is held can have all of the information. It can have who issued it, when did they issue it, right, what regulation, all this kind of stuff. And so now if you write the code into the law, or I'm sorry, the law into the code, the code can actually prevent non-compliant trades from occurring. And so you take regulators from being reactive and put them in a proactive position that saves them time, money, and resources. So to them, this is like a dream come true.
Right. Now, it will take some time for our many legislators and regulators to fully understand the underlying technical know-how and take a view of combining, law and technology. But yes, our legal system is highly outdated. And I have no doubt that I actually agree completely that blockchain will benefit regulations over time to a great extent.
Yeah, look, people fear what they don't understand, right? But in this one case, it actually is technology that will make the regulators better at their job.
Right.
Right. Okay. So before we wrap up, I do a whole bunch of kind of fire round questions. First is, what company do you believe is the most important in cryptocurrency and blockchain today that is not your own? So you can't say Republic, but what's the most important company out there?
Well, one of our lead investors is Binance. And I love just how long-term of an approach they've been adopting. I would say Binance.
Why are they important though? Right. So I agree that they've done a bunch of stuff, yep, right? That they've taken this very particular view, but why do you think they're important to the overall ecosystem?
To have that pool of capital and deploying it not for near-term further wealth generation or near-term return, but instead reinvesting it into incubating companies that are clearly not going to issue token and be 100x so that they can sell tomorrow, but that are addressing problems in the underdeveloped or the developing world. I think the Binance Lab team, the Binance incubation program, I haven't seen anyone else in the industry with this level of influence that are playing that long game, that mm-hmm. long of a game. Mm-hmm. And because of that I think that over time, the net influence of what they're doing today, we're going to see in years to come.
I'm long CZ. I think a lot of people don't understand how kind of critical he is and the way he thinks. So we'll see what happens there. All right, next question. If you had a magic wand and you could wave it and change any regulation or improve any regulation, what would it be?
I would take away the $1 million limit on BCF and make it much more, pragmatic and appealing for larger projects.
What would you put the limit at?
$20 million, I think, would be a reasonable limit.
So Reg CF would go from $1.07 million to $20 million limit.
Correct. And we submitted a letter to the chairman of the SEC and hope that he can use his discretion to lift the cap.
could they actually do that?
In my opinion, he certainly has the authority to do so.
And so he could actually just decide this should be a higher limit and we're going to go ahead and change it.
Correct.
Got it. Well, maybe we'll tweet at him a couple of times and get him to do that. All right. What's the one thing you believe in crypto that you think a high majority of other people would disagree with you on?
That the fully tokenized world will probably come sooner than most people think, I would say in less than 10 years. And that within a decade, I still think that we're going to get rid of extreme poverty around the world because we're going to see that level of adoption of crypto technology, of crypto assets in general.
Do you think that more people in that 10-year period will adopt Bitcoin or tokenized securities?
They will use Bitcoin to invest into tokenized assets. That is, it may be a tokenized Monet, and now they're able to acquire a tiny bit of it, or you know, one billionth of the Ritz-Carlton Dow in Tribeca. Mm-hmm. And so the tokenized traditional assets will bring forth relatability and encourage people who are now standing on the sideline, interested, but haven't dived in to actually take that step to be engaged.
Got it. All right. One more question before I end everyone. Let you ask me one question. So you think of a question, but completely non-related to crypto. We're just going to admit that aliens exist, right? So aliens are out there somewhere. We always think of aliens as comparative to humans, right? You in movies and the way that they're depicted in sci-fi, it's always some sort of human-like creature. Do they have pets? Like, do you think that there's alien animals and alien human type creatures? Or do you think that they're just one homogenous creature?
My bet would be that they do have pets.
Why?
Pets, you know, just fills a human need for comfort and security, you know, to be more. And so I imagine that a highly evolved species probably would also have highly evolved EQ, emotion. Mm-hmm. And if that species has emotion, then it will have things like pets.
Pets, right. Yeah. Okay. I think nobody's ever answered it with an EQ-focused answer, but I think that you're probably more right than wrong.
What's the most common answer to that question?
The funniest one is that we're the pets, right? I think the most common is, yes, there are pets, and everyone's got kind of a different reason as to why.
You're one of the most prolific crypto investor out there. Out of the world of like STO securities, tokenized assets, what excites you the most in the past month that didn't come on your radar until literally the past 30 days? In terms of a sector, a project.
Okay. So I'm going to cheat a little bit. It's probably not the last 30 days, but I think it's something that is not very well understood. But it's exciting to me. And I don't think we're there yet, but people are building it. I've seen a couple of companies pop up. I won't mention who yet because I don't think that they're public with it. I'm really interested in this idea of on-chain cash flow or on-chain debt, right? And the idea being that it really doesn't have that much to do with blockchain. It has everything to do with automation, right? And so, you know, I'm on record as saying blockchain is simply the foundational technology that will empower or unlock the true value of automation, right? So if you think about in an automated world, most assets will not comply with that world because they're not digital. So they're paper-based or they're electronic-based, right? Kind of like DTCC today, etc. If we can use this technology to actually create digital assets, native digital assets, not, oh, this is a representation of a share in a company, but it is the share in the company.
Right.
Now what you've done is you've laid the foundation for every stock, bond, currency, and commodity to be digitized, and now automation is unleashed. So the example that I use is, if you're an employee at a company and you own a house, normally what happens is you go and you apply for a loan, right? And when you apply for that loan, the lender underwrites you and the asset. They say, okay, what house are you buying? How much does it cost? How much money do you have to put down? What's your ability to pay back? Your credit score, all that kind of stuff. You then take out the loan, you put some money down, you get paid every 2 weeks from your employer. That money goes into your bank account. You then take some of that money and you pay your mortgage payment every month. Well, my bet is that at some point in the future, your employer is going to make two payments. They're going to pay you your salary net of that mortgage payment, because the bank or the lender is going to say, I'll underwrite you, right, as the borrower, and I'll underwrite the asset, but I'm more likely to give you the loan and also at a lower interest rate if I can underwrite the corporation rather than the borrower, right? And so now, today that might be possible. It'd be pretty complex and inefficient to do, and you know, accountants at companies would hate it, right? But if we can actually get into a truly digital world, these micropayments and the ability to start to automate this stuff unlocks huge value, but also it changes the way that humans interact with money. Because what would that do? It would give you as an individual consumer cheaper capital.
Yep.
And we know that cheaper capital unleashes innovation, and we know that innovation actually changes inequality, right? And so that's a really long threaded thing that it's reliant on a lot of ifs. But I think that this digitization of assets is the key to building that future.
Projects like Dharma, the early phase of that evolution, you think?
So Dharma, for those that don't know, it's a protocol in which anyone can go on and build debt-like instruments, right, or debt-like services on this protocol that's based on blockchain, right? I think that they are absolutely one of the fundamental layers, and if they don't win, somebody will win in terms of a protocol for debt-like instruments. The part that may not be as popular with the crypto community is I actually don't know if blockchain is the right technology, right? We think a lot about asset management for our business in the digital age, not in the blockchain age, in the digital age. Now, today, blockchain is actually the best technology, right? In majority of cases. And so what blockchain is heavily reliant on in many of those cases is that we will move to a decentralized world. But if we just move to a digital centralized world, so not for money, for Bitcoin, et cetera, but just, you know, for debt or whatever, does blockchain have to be the right technology? I don't know yet. And I think that's the work that we're trying to do to figure that out. But if we do move to a truly decentralized blockchain world, the ability to not only get access to this and unleash automation, but then do it without central authorities, we could sit here all day and talk about possibilities, right? Right. I mean, it would be absolutely incredible in terms of the economic benefit for both individuals and society that would unleash.
So that's the hope, right? I mean, today there isn't truly any example of a truly decentralized initiative, project, network, but hopefully that one day we'll see some manifestation of that.
Look, I'll leave you one last thing. I actually wrote about it today. Bitcoin, in my opinion, is going to do more to solve the income inequality gap than anything else in the world. And people say, oh, that's an insane statement from somebody who's, you know, just talking their book, right? I went back, and in 1998, the IMF issued this paper that describes the impact of inflation on income inequality. And the things that it talks about is things like there's insiders and outsiders. They put people in two camps. The insiders are people who can get inflation-adjusted wage contracts. So every year my income goes up X percent to accommodate for inflation and prevent impact of inflation. Real asset ownership. So when I get paid my salary, I take my money and I put it in something other than an inflation currency, right? Things like that. Bitcoin completely removes the dynamic inflationary rate or the ability for a central bank to influence that. And so if you believe the IMF's work that shows inflation has driven more income inequality in the last 50 years than most things, if you move to a disinflationary model and a decentralized model where there's no influence on a day-to-day, month-to-month, quarter-to-quarter basis of inflation, interest rates, etc., all of a sudden you start to close that inequality gap. Right. And so to your point, like that's just Bitcoin.
Right.
You're talking about even bigger, just all assets in general. But I do truly believe that this is the type of stuff that, you know, it's the Gandhi quote, right? First they ignore you, then they laugh, then they fight, and then you win.
Right.
We're probably past the laughing stage. fights are coming, right? So you start seeing central banks saying, "Ah, this is stupid. It's dangerous. It's we'll see how bad the fight is, right?"
No, apparently Jimmy Dimon doesn't give a shit.
the Jimmy Dimon and I are going to end up friends at some point. Well, you mark my words. But I think that's the stuff that, you know, I get excited about, and so I think we're just getting started here. And the entrepreneurs who are really kind of understanding the technology, understanding the law, are going to build things we can't imagine. And that's really where we want to invest, right? I think you guys obviously are operating, and so that's stuff that gets exciting.
I'm definitely a fellow believer.
Absolutely. All right, man. Thank you so much for coming. This is super fun, and then we'll have to do it again as you guys keep progressing.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, everyone. Pomp here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.